Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Unitarian Church in St. Stephen's Green in Dublin. Welcome if you're sitting here in the church. Thank you for being here. Welcome if you're watching on the webcam, and welcome if you're listening back during the week on our podcast. We are glad you are here, and thank you for taking the time to join us for our service this morning. And my name is Will O'Connell. I'm a member of the congregation here. We have a long, proud tradition in this church of members of the congregation taking the services. And I'm the person today who is leading the service. We have an even better deal today in that lots of members of the congregation are going to help put the service together. It's called a favourite reading service, and I'm delighted to be your Dahi O'Shea today for the Rose of Tralee. Or, as the names escape me, Jules Holland to a miscellany of musicians, only to stand them up in the middle of the show by playing myself. Thank you to all our readers. It's a bit of a go with the flow day because somebody says, oh, I'll read, and then you look around and go, they're not here, so I'll just cross that person off and put them on. But so I'm delighted we've got about 8 or 9 readers today. We'll have some music as well. So before, I usually leave thanks for the end of the service, but there are just a couple of thanks plus one that I'd like to make at the beginning. I'd like to thank Pamela McCarthy and Gavin Byrne for standing in for me when I was unable to take a service due to illness and work. I really appreciate you, and I wanted to say that publicly, so thank you. I also want to thank David Heap, who brought me to this church 15 years ago. Charlie is sitting in his seat there. Good to see you, Charlie. I don't know if David is going to be able to listen back to this podcast, but if you are, David, we love you very much and thinking of you. So, there's nothing you can do that can't be done. There's nothing you can sing that can't be sung. There's nowhere you can be that isn't where you're meant to be. It's easy. All you need is love. Please join me with the affirmation of this church before I light the chalice. It's, if you go to the back cover of the hymnal, it should be written there. And then I will light our chalice. The chalices of Unitarian Universalism are lit all over the world at this time, to put some light into a dark world. So please join me. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine. This do we covenant with each other, and with God. We shall now have our first hymn, and it's number 163, For the Earth Forever Turning. This is from number 468 in the hymnal, if anybody wants to follow along the affirmations in the back. Number 468, we need one another. We need one another when we mourn and would be comforted. We need one another when we are in trouble and afraid. We need one another when we are in despair, in temptation, and need to be recalled to our best selves again. We need one another when we would accomplish some great purpose and cannot do it alone. We need one another in the hour of success, when we look for someone to share our triumphs. We need one another in the hour of defeat, when with encouragement we might endure and stand again. We need one another when we come to die and would have gentle hands prepare us for the journey. All our lives we are in need, and others are in need of us. And that's the words of George E. Odell. And thank you to those who joined in there in the readings. Please join me in saying the words that Jesus taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, for ever and ever. Amen. Thank you. So if you're reading today, I will call upon you. You don't need to remember the order in which I told you were coming, but I'm delighted that Gavin is coming up to be our first reader. Thanks, Gavin.
What if the world's religions aren't competing, but rather one unfolding truth? So Dr. Kat Eggedemian is a human rights expert. She's a writer, an advisor on religion, ethics, and social justice. And she's got experience working across multiple continents, and she explores how faith and moral frameworks shapes identity and society. This short article struck me because much of what she says can also be said about our Unitarian tradition. I was born in Iran after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, when religion became the architecture of public life. But it was precisely this fusion of faith and power that forced my family to flee. We were persecuted not for breaking laws, but for belonging to a minority religious community, the Baha'is, a persecution that continues to this day. And this experience taught me how religion can be used to exclude, to dehumanize, and to dominate. But it also taught me that ignoring religion is not the answer. More than 80% of the world's population identifies with a religion. Yet in many parts of the world, especially in the West, religion is treated as a private matter, something best kept out of polite conversation, or at worst, a source of division and danger. We live in a paradox, a deeply religious world that increasingly doesn't know how to talk about religion. This silence isn't neutral. It creates a kind of cultural illiteracy, especially at a time when religion continues to shape geopolitics, social movements, and personal lives, from the rise of religious nationalism to faith-based responses to humanitarian crises. And in places like the United States, it's becoming even more central to public discourse, often with high political stakes. So how do we talk about religion in a world that needs moral clarity, but fears moral language? One idea that has helped me reframe how we talk about religion comes from my own faith, the Baha'i concept of progressive revelation. It teaches that the world's major religions are expressions of the same spiritual reality, revealed at different times to meet the evolving needs of humanity. They are not rival ideologies, but chapters in a single story. Not different truths, but different reflections of one truth. So imagine if we approached religion not as a set of camps to defend or oppose, but as a shared inheritance. What if we stopped asking which one is right and started asking what they're trying to show us about justice, humility, forgiveness, the soul, and the sacredness of life? This shift from debating difference to seeking shared meaning isn't just theoretical. I've seen it work. In refugee communities in the Middle East, I witnessed how grassroots interfaith efforts helped displaced people from opposing religious backgrounds begin to heal. In one camp in Jordan, Christian and Muslim women began cooking together during Ramadan and Easter, eventually hosting communal feasts for the wider community. These weren't institutionalized programs, but quiet acts of dignity and repair, rooted in faith and in the will to see the human behind the label. This idea that spiritual truth unfolds over time has changed how I live. It's shaped how I raise my children, how I relate to neighbors of different beliefs, and how I engage in public life. It helps me stay curious instead of defensive, and to approach others not through fixed categories, but with an openness to what we might learn from one another. And that's the heart of it, really. Moral imagination, the ability to see not just what is, but what could be. And it invites us to ask new kinds of questions. What does it mean to live a meaningful life? How do we hold both reverence and reason in the same hand? What truths do our traditions carry that the world still needs? And what happens when we stop talking about religion and start listening to it? These are not easy questions, but they do matter. While secular frameworks offer many tools, they often fall short of naming the deepest yearnings of the human spirit. And while religion has been misused, it can also be reclaimed as a source of clarity, compassion, and shared purpose. Recognizing the wisdom in religion doesn't mean denying the harm it's caused. It means telling the full story, separating faith from fanaticism and choosing not silence, but better language, language rooted in humility, inquiry, and hope. We don't need less religion in public life. We need better ways of talking about it, ways that allow both believers and non-believers to engage meaningfully with honesty and depth. Thank you.
Thank you, Gavin. Our next reader is Janet.
Morning, everybody. This morning I'm going to read from John O'Donohue's Benedictus. My love for animals is on display in my choice of readings. I'm going to read a lovely few lines from John O'Donohue in which he invites us to appreciate them and then appreciate them again. Here we go. To learn from animal being. Nearer to the earth's heart, deeper within its silence, animals know this world in a way that we never will. We who are ever distanced and distracted by the parade of bright windows thought opens. Their seamless presence is not fractured thus. Stranded between time gone and time emerging, we manage seldom to be where we are, whereas they are always looking out from the here and the now. May we learn to return and rest in the beauty of animal being. Learn to lean low, leave our locked minds, and with freed senses, feel the earth breathing within us. May we enter into lightness of spirit and slip frequently into the feel of the wild. Let the clear silence of our animal being cleanse our hearts of corrosive words. May we learn to walk upon the earth with all their confidence and clear-eyed stillness, so that our minds might be baptized in the name of the wind and the light and the rain.
Beautiful, Janet, thank you. Our next reader is Denise.
In April 1910, Theodore Roosevelt delivered a speech in Paris which was called Citizenship in a Republic. This excerpt from that speech has become known as The Man in the Arena. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, nor where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms and great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows at the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with the cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat.
Gurmila Mahagat, Denise. We'll now have our second hymn, which was introduced to me in school, but under a different name, Lead Me, Lord. We also used to sing it in Irish as well. And Josh is going to play it the whole way through. Our words are a little bit different. Thanks, Josh. It's number 83, Winds Be Still. Madeline is our next reader.
I'm going to read you a piece from these now well-known books, The Poetry Pharmacy, which gives a poem for every emotional problem. Seems easy, doesn't it? So this one is, the condition he's dealing with this time is the need for encouragement. And first of all, there's a little bit of prose to explain it, and then I'll read the poem. First written just over 100 years ago, this poem has become a fast favorite with the patients who come to my pharmacy. Something about its humor, its lighthearted drive, just makes it all seem so easy. Sometimes when we are lost in the mire of our worries and cares, even taking the next step can seem unfathomably hard, let alone embarking on a new challenge. The voices telling us it cannot be done, whether those of the outside world or more likely of our own doubt and despair, are simply too deafening, too thick. And yet, as this poem so jauntily reminds us, there needn't be anything intimidating about just having a go. Even a task which seems overwhelming, impossible, superhuman, one that nobody we know of has ever done before, can be broken down to a series of steps. We only have to see what they are. Those steps, in turn, can be broken down further. And then, methodically, cheerfully, with the trace of a grin and a song in our hearts, we can just get started. Perhaps, very occasionally, it'll turn out to be impossible. Most of the time, it won't. Either way, and most crucially, we will have done something and probably picked up some new skills along the way. It really is better to have tried and failed than to be left wondering what might have been. What may surprise you the most, if you take this marvelous poem to heart, is how much easier the challenges of your life turn out to be when you take them a little less gloomily. A heavy heart and a weary sigh can stretch a simple task into days on end of worry. But with a little resolve and a cheerful outlook, a week's problems can be dispensed with before lunch. All it takes is a grin and getting started. So the poem is called It Couldn't Be Done by Edgar Albert Guest. Somebody said that it couldn't be done, but he with a chuckle replied that maybe it couldn't, but he would be one who wouldn't say so till he'd tried. So he buckled right in with the trace of a grin on his face. If he worried, he hid it. He started to sing as he tackled the thing that couldn't be done, and he did it. Somebody scoffed, "Oh, you'll never do that. At least no one ever has done it." But he took off his coat and he took off his hat, and the first thing we knew, he'd begun it. The lift of his chin and a bit of a grin, without any doubting or quiddit, he started to sing as he tackled the thing that couldn't be done. And he did it. There are thousands to tell you it cannot be done. There are thousands to prophesy failure. There are thousands to point out to you, one by one, the dangers that wait to assail you. But just buckle in with a bit of a grin. Just take off your coat and go to it. Just start in to sing as you tackle the thing that cannot be done. And you'll do it.
Merci beaucoup, Madeleine. Robin is our next reader. Thanks, Robin.
Good morning. Last December, I turned 80. The good actors here can pretend to be shocked. But when I was in my 70s, they always said, what was it, the 50s or the new 70s? And when I was in my 60s, the 40s or the new 60s. So I asked, rightly so, what are the 80s? The 80s, you're old and live up to it. So, but a niece gave me on my birthday a book called, by Jeff Tibbetts, called Old Age and How to Milk It. And there's many chapters I'd like to, but I'm just going to read the introduction on it. Because, and I'm going to leave it here afterwards if anyone wants to take it. Turning old age can be scary. Be told you're over the hill when you don't even remember reaching the top of it. Suddenly, you discover that there are more bottles in your medicine cabinet than there are in your wine cellar. That after using a laptop, you're never quite sure whether you've just done the weekly shopping online or accidentally booked a fortnight in Bridlington. That whenever you stoop down to tie your shoelaces, this I know, you look for something else to do while you're down there. And you positively look forward to a dull evening at home. Faced with such evidence, it's easy to think that your best days are behind you, especially when it takes you longer to unwrap the packaging of a new mobile phone than it does for your grandchildren to master every one of its multiple functions. But fear not, your glass is not necessarily half empty. With a little creative thinking, many of the apparent negatives of old age can be turned into positives. And by adding a healthy dollop of cunning verging on deviousness, you can often turn your seniority to your advantage. As Quentin Crisp said, the joy of being older is that in one's life, one can, towards the end of the run, overact appallingly. So look on the bright side. Even though your back may go out more than you do, and when you do paint the town red, you need a long rest before you use the second coat, these years come may just prove to be the most enjoyable in your life. Now, I'm going to pick just three one of the examples in the book was the senior moment. So here's three. Did I really walk out of the shop without pain? Sorry, it must have been a senior moment. Did I actually throw out that ghastly porcelain dragon that your mother bought us? Sorry, I've been having a few senior moments lately. Was I really driving down the long way of that one-way street, officer? I'm terribly sorry. Put it down to a senior moment. So in answer to my original question, what are the 80s? The 80s and the other age like are the golden age. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. Round of applause. I think we have a few birthdays in the church today, tomorrow, and this week, but just wishing everyone a happy birthday. And thank you so much for that, Robin. We'll take that as the children's story for today, the time for all ages. Our next reader is Liz. Thank you, Liz.
Follow that. I'm taking two short readings from a woman called Mae Morton, who is largely a forgotten poet, even though she only died in 1957, a Limerick woman who spent most of her life in Belfast. And she is the kind of person who, she was very involved with literary life in Belfast. She was the secretary. She wrote the correspondence. She did all the things that enable organizations to function. But people like her rarely get any thanks for it. And she was largely, as I say, not treated terribly seriously by the men writers within the kind of literary group in Belfast. He used to meet in Campbell's coffee shop. And then she wrote a collection of 30s of poetry, and then she wrote another poem, and then she sent in a 200-line poem called Spindle and Shuttle. It was a competition for the Festival of Britain Northern Ireland Prize. And it's a wonderful poem. It's about the millies, the mill workers, working class women who were part of that huge industry in Belfast. And she won first prize. And she even beat John Hewitt, who had submitted The Colony, which is considered as a masterpiece. So she had her great moment of glory. She was born into a Church of Ireland family in Limerick, but I like to think she was Unitarian in spirit. The first piece is very short, and it's part of an essay she wrote in 1942, while the Nazis were bombing Belfast. She wrote this piece, and it's in a collection called The Pen in Ulster. There must be diversity in unity. And the greater the diversity, the richer the unity. For truth has many aspects. Its white ray is composed of many colors, not only primary and secondary, but multitudinous, as the rich complexity of the human soul. Late in life, she published her last collection, and in it, there's a short poem, which I kind of like. It's called Milestone. I've made friends with age. Why should I weep that I've walked so far? The way I came kindled to beauty in the sunset flame. Youth's fields still mine, with full-eared corn to reap, where in the spring the plowshare furrowed deep. Gleanings of love, a richer yield than fame. Blessing from lips that softly speak my name, and evening's tender radiance till I sleep. Seed time and harvest of the spirit's year. Is this the cycle? Is the ending here? Or having slept, do souls awake once more to live and love and labor as before? If there be fresh adventure, I'll find zest. If sleep be all, I'm content to rest.
Namaste, Liz. Josh is going to read something.
I'm not. I'm going to play you a piece of music from the CD, because for those of you who don't know, and already many of you do, Harry Chapin was a singer-songwriter and a voice of great political and human rights conscience in the 1970s in America. And when my parents were busy, amongst other people, setting up the first multi-denominational primary school in Ireland in 150 years. I'm very proud of this fact. Dad was also working in RTE as a radio producer, and he got the amazing honour of producing an interview with Harry Chapin as he was in town to play, I think, in the Gaiety Theatre, which in those days was one of the main music venues. And he came home with this record. Now, I would have been 4 at the time, so I'm just using my calculations, but this would have been pretty much the summer that the Dalkey School Project was going to open. And this song, which I'm going to play now, was the single that he brought back, his promo copy of the current single that was out. And it's lived in our family and lived in our family's consciousness for all time. But I'm a huge fan of loads of his stuff now. In fact, I remember doing a reading of The Rock here probably about 15 years ago with congregation participation, which was great fun. But I just kind of got to a place where I think hearing it in the music and hearing it as it was originally intended is a more apt way of doing it. So just before Gavin presses play, I want to play this, and I want this reading to go out for three groups of people. I went yesterday to a Dunleary Rathdown celebration of my auntie, Jennifer Johnston, who died in February. And I discovered all sorts of amazing things about her that I never knew before. And my mum and dad, who were very involved in setting up the school. But also, thirdly, and I didn't want to forget this, for John Ward and his memory, much missed member of our congregation who actually sang this song so often, both as a reading and as part of the children's story. This is Flowers Are Red.
Your son marches to the beat of a different drummer, comma, but don't worry, we'll have him joining the parade by the end of the term.
Liz!
School, he got crayons and he started to draw. He put colors all over the paper. Four colors was what he saw. And the teacher said, "What you doing, young man? I'll paint flowers," he said. She said, "It's not the time for art, young man. And anyway, flowers are green and red. There's a time for everything, young man. A way it should be done. You got to show concern for everyone else, or you're not the only one." And she said,
"Flowers are red, young man. Green leaves are green. There's no need to see flowers any other way, the way they always have been seen."
But the little boy said, "There are so many colors in the rainbow, so many colors in the morning sun, so many colors in the flower, and I see everyone." "There's ways that things should be, and you'll paint flowers the way they are. So repeat after me." And she said,
"Flowers are red, young man. Green leaves are green. No need to see flowers any other way, the way they always have been seen."
But the little boy said again, "There are so many colors in the rainbow, so many colors in the morning sun, so many colors in the flower, and I see everyone." Well, the teacher put him in a corner. She said, "It's for your own good, and you won't come out till you get it right, and are responding like you should." Well, finally he got lonely, frightened thoughts filled his head, and he went up to that teacher, and this is what he said. And he said, "Flowers are red, and green leaves are green. There's no need to see flowers any other way than the way they always have been seen." Of course, time went by like it always does. They moved to another town, and the little boy went to another school. This is what he found. The teacher there was smiling. She said, "Painting should be fun, and there are so many colors in a flower, so let's use every one." But that little boy painted flowers, indeed rows of green and red. And when the teacher asked him why, this is what
he said. And he said, flowers are red and green leaves are green. There's no need to see flowers any other way than the way they always have been seen. But there still must be a way to have our children say, there are so many colors in the rainbow, so many colors in the morning sun, so many colors in the flower, and I see everyone.
Thank you very much, Josh. Thank you, Harry Chapin. All my life's a circle, sunrise and sundown. Beautiful Harry Chapin, who was instrumental actually in the Live Aid movement, but died before that got off the ground, the mantle of which was taken up by our own Bob Geldof. I won't get political, but he'd be a pretty good president. So would you, Gavin. Thank you, Josh. Beautiful. We're now going to transition into a quiet time, a period of reflection. I'm going to say a few words to bring us there, and then our final readers will be Jennifer and Bridget after that, and then we'll finish our service. Jules Holland may be appearing on the piano in the middle of that, and we'll have our final hymn. So I invite you to just take yourself to a comfortable place, as you feel that may be, if it's helpful. Breathing in through the nose, holding and releasing with a sigh, if it's helpful. And again, in through the nose, hold, with a sigh. The sigh tells our bodies this is a safe place. And I'll read these words. Meditation is not a way to enlightenment, nor is it a method of achieving anything at all. It is peace and blessedness itself. It is the actualization of wisdom, the ultimate truth of the oneness of all things. Meditation need not be limited to time spent sitting with our eyes closed. We can practice a type of meditation simply in the way we live our lives each day. Often we think about our lives in terms of what we hope to accomplish, but in truth, we don't always have to aim at goals or results. Whatever we are engaged in doing throughout our day, we can cherish the experience of simply being alive and sensing our connection with everything else that is alive. We can remember our unity with others and with spirit. When we stop focusing on a destination we are striving to reach and instead focus on the present moment in all its fullness, we experience aliveness without struggle and enjoy a deep sense of calm. Paradoxically, when we stop concentrating on effort and relax into being present, giving whatever we are doing all our attention, we find ourselves accomplishing our goals with greater ease. Today, this moment, I relax into being alive.
gosh, that was moving. I don't know if anyone else found that really moving. That was moving. I loved it. Thank you. I chose a reading today from the book called We Can Do Hard Things, which is the companion book to the podcast of the same name. It's Glennon Doyle, who wrote the amazing Untamed. I've read from that book here before, and her wife, Abby Wambach, and her sister, Amanda Doyle. So they wrote this book, sort of like the pharmacy that Madeline was talking about before. There are 20 questions, and after these 20 questions, there are little snippets, either from the three podcast hosts themselves or from the guests that they had on the podcast. So little nuggets, and it's something I think you can return to again and again when these questions come to you. Questions like, how do I figure out what I want? Parenting, am I doing this right? Why am I so angry? Etc. So I'll just read one passage from the section that is called, Why Am I Like This? Life is chaos. We grab onto religion, wellness plans, busyness, and productivity because, bless our hearts, we just want a little control. We're just trying to feel okay. It's like life is the sinking Titanic and everybody's scrambling to stay at the tippy top, to stay in our minds and our dogmas, because we know if we let go of these structures, we'll sink and land in our bodies. Our bodies are where all of our memories, trauma, wildness, and messiness are. But our bodies are also where healing is. Healing doesn't happen by replacing our failed dogma with another dogma, by finding another religion, another diet, another discipline, another whatever. But there is a magical moment of possibility that arises if we allow our false certainty to be replaced with nothingness and do the impossible work of sitting there, clueless and surrendered, long enough. It's like we're sitting on the couch with a puzzle in front of us, and we're hunched over, and our brows are furrowed, and we're trying to solve it. We have to stop trying. We have to abandon the puzzle in front of us and sit there on the couch, empty-handed and still. This feels panicky and terrifying at first, because with our hands and minds no longer busy, all we're left with is who we are and what we have to heal from. Our childhood stuff comes up. It all comes up. We start to struggle with whatever we've been avoiding our entire life. But if we stay with ourselves and don't grab for somebody else's false certainty, a healing journey becomes possible. On that journey, we slowly learn how to be real adults, responsible, whole people who can regulate ourselves and withstand the uncertainty of life without grabbing for and using people or false certainty to make ourselves feel okay. We finally learn that our problem was never that we couldn't solve the puzzle of life. The problem was that life was never a puzzle at all. Life is a dance. There's no solving life. There's just letting ourselves feel and move to the music.
Thank you, Jennifer. Back at you. I found that moving. Richard is going to be our next reader. Just to say, what I love about these is it's a pick and mix, but always a sort of theme emerges out of a favorite reading service. And I know we can discuss coffee downstairs what we think the theme is. Bridget, thank you.
And the theme continues with my reading. This is a story about two little girls, Valerie and her friend Lisa. I was in eighth grade, sitting in the library with my very best friend in the whole world. Her name was Lisa. We were working. We were really giggling and passing notes to one another and messing around. When Lisa went really quiet for a moment, she has this faraway look in her eyes and she says, Valerie, I just can't wait until Judgment Day. I said, what do you mean? She says, well, when it's just us, it'll be just us. I can't wait until it's just us are left. And I said, well, where will everyone else go? And she looked at me very uncomfortable. She says, well, you know, down there. It was that moment that I had to break to my very best friend the fact that I was not Christian. I could see the blood drain from her face. How could her very best friend not be saved, not be good, not be Christian? She had inherited a theology that divided the world into good and bad, right and wrong, saved and unsaved. Her theology severed her from her own deep knowing that her very best friend was good and beloved. It's like her theology stole her from me at that moment. She was trying to make sense of it all, tried to hold both, but she couldn't hold both, and she had to let me go. I just couldn't believe that there could be a God who could send me to hell, I said. This young girl, Valerie, goes into a Christian church and she meets the organist and she says this to her. She says, I can't believe that there is a God who would send me to hell. She's in from eighth grade. I can't believe that either, she said. She saw the look on my face and explained, I think that there are many paths. It just doesn't make sense otherwise. Her name was Faye, and she was the first Christian I had ever met who did not believe that I was going to hell. I would go on to meet many more people like her and learn that there are many ways to be Christian, just as there are many ways to be Sikh. Our traditions have treasure chests filled with scriptures, songs, and stories. Some empower us to cast judgment on others, and others shimmer with the call to love above all else. 15 years after I thought our friendship was over, Lisa would reach out to me with an apology. She would still be Christian and I would still be Sikh, but she would have long abandoned that particular theology that tried to sever us from one another. She had gone on her own journey and had eventually come back to our friendship. In the end, we learned that love is the way, the truth, and the life.
Thanks so much, Bridget. We'll now take up our collection, and as Bill used to say, Jules Holland will play the piano to cover the sound of jangling money. Thank you, Josh. Just just reminds me, I played a few bum notes there when I was playing, but hopefully, some of you are so deaf you didn't notice. I'm joking. It just reminded me when Josh was playing there in jazz music. So if you play a wrong note, play it again, and then play it again. Play it again. That's jazz. Our notices. Please join us for coffee and tea downstairs after the service. If you're here for the first time today, your coffee is free, but please do come downstairs. Fair trade tea and coffee, I should say, as well. It's important. Rory will bring us on two city walks over the coming weeks. The first walk is today, and we'll start directly after this service. Rory will bring us on a journey entitled Nonconformist Roots, tracing the early history of our congregation in the area between St. Patrick's and Christ Church cathedrals. Pam leads our weekly service of reflection in the church every Wednesday from 1:05 to 1:35. These sessions can also be accessed live on our webcam. The book club is reading the Aspern Papers by Henry James this month. They will gather on the last Wednesday of the month in the vestry. The last Wednesday of the month is the 24th of September, and they'll be gathering in the vestry. Please talk to Alison for details. Thank you. Culture Night is Friday the 19th of September. It's coming up soon. How is this happening? Our programme this year will include a series of musical recitals beginning at 5:30 p.m. We will have the Dawson Chorus, a wonderfully newly formed choir from this neighbourhood, and our own Classical Musicians Network, organist Alicia Borsuk, and the evening will conclude with Josh and Mark Hutchinson's Mind Travels. Thank you to everyone who's volunteered to help us on the night. So that's Culture Night. October. Our Harvest Thanksgiving lunch will be on Sunday the 5th of October, directly after the Harvest service. All are invited to share food and enjoy company and conversation. Do you know what it says? All are invited to share food and enjoy company and conversion. So if you'd like to be if you would like to be converted, then please join us on Sunday the 5th of October. Diners are asked to make a donation, which will be sent to Christian Aid. And volunteers are needed to provide food, prepare the room, and serve and clean up afterwards. And please speak to Bridget about that. Please take a copy of our September's Auscult magazine. It's on the table outside. And just a reminder to all the guardians of this church, thank you so much. There's a managing committee meeting tomorrow evening at 7:30 p.m. And Gavin has asked me to say on the table over there is the sign-up form. If anybody wants to put their name down for the Seeking Paradise reading group, September 25th of September to the 4th of December, 7 to 8:30. So if you know what I'm talking about, then great. If not, speak to Gavin, or there's more details in Auscult magazine. And Josh is going to tell us about a concert. Thanks, Josh.
I actually was laughing a little bit at your story about jazz, because I was thinking one of the anecdotes that came up yesterday at this thing for Jennifer Johnston was the fact that in our family we had had a dinner, an afternoon tea at my parents' house once, and my aunt had made a bold pronouncement, and my sister called her out on it because she knew she was talking BS. And Jennifer held on to it like a dog with a bone for a few minutes, and then when Becky, you know, proved that she was right, she admitted that her parents, but with also my dad's parents, which is possibly where I get it from too, had taught, instilled in them the knowledge that if you say something with enough confidence in your voice, that everybody will assume that you know what you're talking about. So now I've let go of my, now I'm sunk in this church now, I've let go of my secret of life. But anyway, I have not been up here advertising gigs much recently, because 3 years ago I retired from live performance. I'd had enough of it. I enjoyed the performance. I enjoyed the creation of the music. I did not enjoy the selling of the gigs or the selling of the CDs, and I thought, oh, enough of this. I'm busy enough at church. I'm accompanying lots of people's exams. And then I missed it a little bit, so I'm jumping back in. I'm hoping to finish up an album next year. But in the meantime, I'm doing a concert in the Cobblestones on Thursday evening. The Cobblestones, if you don't know, is in Smithfield. It's usually known as a traditional Irish music venue, but they have a piano, so I am making use of that. I'm going to play and sing a few of my songs, take them for a spin, see how it goes. If anyone's around on Thursday evening would like to come. This time I did a concert with another group of people a few weeks ago, and some of you were very kind to come to that, but this will be just me, all on my own, and it'd be lovely to see you. Thanks a million.
Thanks so much, Josh. I'm glad you're back gigging again. I have to give him time now to get up to that beautiful organ that we restored a few years ago. A few more thanks. Just thank you to everybody who contributed to the service today and made it possible. We're a little bit after 12, so I'm not going to name you individually, and then I might forget somebody as well. So just, you know who you are. Thank you for reading. Thank you for preparing the church, for being here. And thank you for trusting me to be up here today, not naming anybody. Gavin. I appreciate it. It's nice to be back. Okay, we're going to finish our service today with the beautiful Beethoven, Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee, number 29. Joyful music, lift us onwards. Let us just finish with these words. Be the reason for somebody to smile today. Remember to breathe and remember to laugh. Peace.